Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be shining the spotlight on Pope Benedict's encyclical, Spes Salvi, taking a look at Michelangelo's Last Judgment fresco in the Sistine Chapel, and presenting a feature by the title of Popes on the Bosphorus. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. I'd like to begin today by listening to the voice of the Holy Father.
Questa domenica è dunque un giorno quanto mai indicato per offrire alla Chiesa intera e a tutti gli uomini di buona volontà la mia seconda enciclica.
That was Pope Benedict speaking of the second encyclical of his pontificate by the title of Spes Salvi, or Saved by Hope.
Si intitola Spes Salvi.
It was on the first Sunday of Advent, a season which is preeminently in the Church, the season of hope. That's why this encyclical on hope can be considered a timely one, published to coincide with the beginning of the liturgical year, when the Sunday Gospel focuses on the final judgment, the end of human history as we know it, held out to us as a source of hope, not of terror. I mention all this to introduce my first guest speaker on today's broadcast. He's the Vice Dean of the Faculty of Theology at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome, Professor of Moral Theology, Dominican Father Bruce Williams. Father Bruce, who over the past few days has been sharing with us some of his thoughts on this encyclical, and in a few moments will continue to do so, expressing both admiration at the elegance of it, but also surprise, at first anyway, in reading some of the passages. He mentions in particular a passage focusing on judgment.
I admit I was a little surprised at first. He quite frankly took on the caricature of judgment that had grown in modern Christianity, starting from early modern Christianity, as a frightful thing, you know, as expressed in the art of the period and since. And he transforms this, I should say retransforms this, back into the harbinger of hope that the icon of judgment was in the ancient church. It was the promise of the vindication of justice, finally, and for everyone.
Father Bruce then went on to remark to me how Pope Benedict follows these thoughts by moving on to write about purgatory, in a way that should make the Catholic faith not just palatable, but appealing. Let's listen.
Purgatory is presented as a way of bolstering our hope that the communion we have with others in love is not broken by the grave, that even across the boundaries of the grave, we can still reach out to others and help them with our prayers, join our prayers to theirs, as it were, as they are undergoing a purification, which he describes, again, very gracefully, as being both painful because it is searing, but also as enlivening, as one comes into clear awareness of the glory of Christ, you know, and is being completely transformed into his image.
The music you've just been hearing announces the end of the encyclical. It's the Hail Mary, Star of the Sea, a prayer which addresses that notion of being on a voyage, needing guidance, and ultimately being able to depend upon the Star of the Sea.
Mary is chief among the saints, but she is indeed one among many saints and for that matter, of saints and angels, and saints here on earth, in whose help we can confide as if it were secondary objects of hope. All of this is embraced within our hope in God. We don't hope in Mary or any of the other creatures independently of our hope in God or as adding anything to what God is doing. But God works through the creatures, especially the creatures he has made in his own image. Often the way God does intervene and with his help in our lives is through the love and the ministrations of others. And we are expected to reach out for help. Pope doesn't stress this, but it was unmistakably there in his discussion of the appropriateness of depending upon the help of the saints and preeminently of Mary, that it would be a defect on our part to ignore these intermediate sources of help that God offers us. You know, they're not in competition with God. They come from God. And he has been saying throughout the encyclical that we likewise should be ministers of hope to one another, you know, that by the good we do for one another, you know, those others who are the beneficiaries of it are led to further hope. There's one point just on that, that the encyclical wasn't setting out to answer all questions. It was raising some provocative questions and inviting reflection and making some suggestions by way of answers that we might, at least what direction we might look in. But one of the questions that I feel was not expressly included here, but which I couldn't fail to see between the lines of what he was saying about Christians needing to be hopeful, and as people energized with hope and, of course, faith and love, ministers of hope to others, and first of all to one another. He's speaking, one would understand, of Christians as so many individual believers. But it also seems to me that this raises questions about the church corporately, that the church needs to be an agent of hope. It has to be perceived by people as an agent of hope, by its members, first of all, and also by others in the larger human community. A Canadian priest some years ago remarked, if the church is not experienced by people, including its own people, as an agent of hope, then it's experienced as a burden. And most people are already much too overburdened. So I find this encyclical inviting me to do is reflect more on how the church as community and those of us who are in various positions of leadership in the church community can help the church to become more completely, more adequately, more transparently a minister of hope. As I say, that's a question that is not even raised, let alone answered, in the encyclical. But it's one that the encyclical invites reflection on.
And the Pope writes that there's a crisis of faith in today's society, no? And that people are looking for hope in the wrong places.
Yes, but I mean, to play devil's advocate here for a moment, one could rejoin that the tendency to look for hope in the wrong places can be traced back historically to a time when people who had been accustomed to look to the church for hope were disappointed. I think a lot of these secularizing, liberalizing, individualizing influences that the Pope is criticizing as characteristic of the modern period arose partially, at least, in reaction to the deficiency of the church in those periods as a credible agent of hope. Would the French Revolution, which he mentions, for example, and all of its atrocious excesses, would that have been necessary if the church in France at that time had been a more credible minister of hope?
Our thanks there go to the Vice Dean of the Faculty of Theology at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome, Professor of Moral Theology, Dominican Father Bruce Williams. And now, picking up on the Last Judgment and how it's often depicted by artists as terrifying, we go over to the Sistine Chapel and take a look at how Michelangelo envisaged it. We do that with a professor of fine arts. She's Breda Ennis. Breda, we're on to the last judgment again, and we're going to speak about the damned. Is that right?
Yes.
At the bottom of the right-hand corner, looking at this big fresco. Frightening, huh?
Yeah, I would say actually quite terrifying.
scary. Yeah.
It's funny, it's the type of scene that the more you look at it, the more you discover, and the more horrifying you realise it is. And because...
It's the River Styx, no?
Yes, yeah.
And there's the boat.
Yes, and the boat of Charon. And you see that here you have Charon with the oar ready to literally hit the damned and just kick them out of his boat and bringing them down to hell. But he's not even giving them time to get out of the boat. He's just, he wants to literally wallop them, you know. I mean, you just get the feeling he can't wait to just throw them into hell. I mean, it's terrifying.
He's been depicted as half animal, half human.
Yes,
no?
Yes. In fact, and but what's interesting is the expression in his eyes. You can see that he's concentrating on the group he's kicking out of the boat, and also he's keeping himself in balance, which is interesting here. Let's say one leg is in the boat, and the other leg is on the edge of the boat, and it has the claw of a devil. You know, so it's
a claw.
Yeah, it's a horrible expression, and the legs are different to. If you notice that, and also the hands that are holding this oar. So you just get the feeling that this oar, it's contrast very much. If you look above that, you see the scene where the angels are calling the dead to arise, and then you have the books of the good and the bad and the trumpets, etc. And you feel that the trumpets are the dynamic in the sense of glorifying in the job that they have to do, you see. But you look at him below, then his oar is darker. It's more vicious looking, and you just know this really heavy stuff. And then all the, again, the angels on this side, again, the angels are wingless angels, baddies, and they're darker, painted darker, actually, by Michelangelo, all the figures, the bad angels on this side. And what they try to do is pull the people who have been condemned down into hell. And generally, some of these people have attributes, for example, pride. In whatever area they sinned, you find that the angels are, let's say, taking them down by the area where they sinned, so to speak, you know, whether it's pride or whatever. This figure has an incredible sense of shame. It's probably one of the figures most portrayed.
It's well known.
Yeah, it's a very well-known piece. And again, look at this figure, very, very voluminous figure. He's put in a terrible situation of shame. You feel like, oh my God, what did I do? Why did I live like that? Why is this happening to me? And it's too late. In that figure, he's able to portray, and that figure is just to the right of the trumpeting angels announcing the last judgment, and just above the boat of Charon. And the figure is so dramatic. It's almost as dramatic as the figures of the saints as above. But he's made this figure a little bit bigger than the others, and he sort of separated the figure from the other group to underline the gravity and the awful sense of, oh my goodness, why did I do what I did, whatever it is. And you can see the devils are hanging on to him at all costs. They're behind him. They're hanging around his legs. They're pulling him down below. Then you have another one, just another devil just below, carrying a person on his back and making sure that he's going to go into the boat. Then you have another person just next to him on the right, trying to go back up again, but there's no way he's going to make it because he's being pushed down from above. And you see, that's the same all over. You see all of the figures on right over to the side of the wall in the middle area, just on the right-hand side. You have all these figures who have been, let's say, judged to go below, and they realize where they're going because they can see what's happening down below at the base, where all the people are falling out of the boat into the hell. Look here, you see they're all falling on top of each other too, because the one thing you notice from the side of the fresco where he's dealing with people who are saved and people who are being condemned, the people who are condemned seem to be more squashed together. There's less space. It's like the suffocation of evil. you just get this feeling that it's all suffocated. And it's like, you know, when you have a crowd of people stampeding on top of each other. This kind of feeling, like another dead, another condemned, a whole bunch, 10 more, 24. You just get the feeling he's just throwing down hundreds and hundreds and thousands. When you look up to the middle section and you see the book of the condemned, you see that it's much larger than the book of the saved. So the good, it's a smaller book and it's a thinner book. The bad, it's a bigger book and it's a thicker book. And you just feel this terrible sense of suffocation, and you know that you're almost like they're falling down in layers into hell. And again, this marvellous figure over here of Minos, where Michelangelo played a trick on the Pope Paul III's secretary, who criticised the fact that he painted figures nude, saying that this was not appropriate for a chapel which would be used by the Pope. And Michelangelo, let's say, just in his naughty little sense of humour, decided to make him as Minos and have him circled by, in right in the middle of hell, with a lovely sense of flames behind and surrounded and squashed by a serpent. So the famous thing that the Pope, when his secretary appealed to him for help, he said, well, you know, I have a lot of power in heaven and some in purgatory, but none in hell. But again, he's standing right over the door here. But I think...
Who's standing right
here? This Minos.
Minos, yeah.
Yeah, and as the Pope's secretary. So the
he's one of the most well-known figures.
Yes.
One of the more...
Yes,
well.
He is, yeah. What is it? Biagio of Cesena, yeah. The papal master of ceremonies. He's kind of caught in an eternal trap in the sense of the fresco. But again, going back to what's going on here, you see this marvellous way that Michelangelo is able to show also the movement of the water here. It's not so visible at the beginning, but you can see the movement of the water as well. And the boat is tilting because there's so many people in it. And yet it contrasts completely with what's going on further up the wall in the fresco. This is why the moods are swinging and changing all over this Last Judgment. The part of the damned, it's suffocation. The part of the saved is a sense of light, uplifting struggle, but going upwards. Then you have all the saints waiting and the martyrs waiting quietly, with Christ who's being dramatic in the centre and just judging.
And warm thanks there to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, for sharing with us her expertise in the field of sacred art. Professor Ennis is currently teaching at the American University of Rome. Finally, as you may recall, a year ago Pope Benedict went on a pastoral journey to Turkey, an occasion which inspired me to produce the feature you're about to hear, one which might just bear the title Popes on the Bosphorus. It was the 28th of November, the place Turkey's capital, Ankara. And in the very first speech of his pastoral journey to Turkey, Pope Benedict XVI quoted from the writings of a pope who came before him. A Roman pontiff, who may not have visited Turkey in days when popes just didn't travel, but spent 10 years there before that as papal representative, precisely from January 1935 to December 1944. The war years, more or less. You'll have guessed with this clue, the Pope is John the 23rd, and the writings he referred to were from the journal of a soul, clearly his soul. Let's listen to Pope Benedict's words.
I have set out upon my visit to Turkey with the same sentiments as those expressed by my predecessor, Blessed John 23, when he came here as Archbishop Giuseppe Roncalli to fulfill the office of papal representative in Istanbul, and I quote him, I am fond of the Turks, is it, to whom the Lord has sent me. I love the Turks.
appreciates the natural qualities of these people who have their own place reserved in the march of civilization.
And the Turkish people returned this fondness to the extent of naming a street after him in Istanbul when he became pope, right by the apostolic delegation. The street is called Paparoncalli Sukat. Being inquisitive, I went to check out the notes that Pope Benedict quotes from in the journal. What I discovered is a particularly poetic and spiritual passage, one I'd like to share with you.
Every evening, from the window of my room, I see an assemblage of boats on the Bosphorus. They come round from the Golden Horn in tens and hundreds. They gather at a given rendezvous and then they light up, some more brilliantly than others, offering a most impressive spectacle of colours and lights. I thought it was a festival on the sea for Bayram, which occurs just about now. But it's the organised fleet fishing for Bonito, large fish, which is said to come from far away in the Black Sea. These lights glow all night, and one can hear the cheerful voices of the fishermen. I find the sight very moving. The other night, towards 1 o'clock, it was pouring with rain, but the fishermen were still there, undeterred from their heavy toil. How ashamed we should feel, we priests, fishers of men, before such an example, to pass from the illustration to the lesson illustrated. What a vision of work, zeal and labour for the souls of men to set before our eyes. Very little is left in this land of the kingdom of Jesus Christ, debris and seeds. But innumerable souls to be won for Christ, lost in this weltering mass of Muslims, Jews and Orthodox. We must do as the fishermen of the Bosphorus do. Work, night and day, with our torches lit, each in his own little boat, at the orders of our spiritual leaders. That is our grave and solemn duty.
Having read this journal, I remembered I once met a person to have lived in both of Roncalli's residences, his townhouse and his summer house, looking out of his windows onto the Bosphorus and actually leafing through his personal books and indeed footnotes within them. He's the late Monsignor Charles Burton Mouton, a former Vatican diplomat who once shared with me vivid memories of this Turkish experience.
I live in Pope John XXIII's house in Istanbul. And in his summer villa on Bayukada, on the Princess Islands in the Sea of Marmara, very lovely villa on this island, a four-story villa with a walled garden. And I would sometimes open a book in the library, and there was a notation in his handwriting, and you felt like you were really living with him in a way, because of the memories that were in those places and in those two residences. And Pope John XXIII renovated the villa and spent 8 or 9 summers there, became very attached to it, as he became very attached to the Turkish people. And it was through Pope John XXIII that diplomatic relations were established between Turkey and the Holy See. But he left, of course, a very wonderful memory in Turkey among all of the people. And of course, it's a non-Christian country. It's a Muslim country. But he had great respect among them. And of course, Pope John XXIII had very great interest in ecumenism and in establishing the various offices in the Holy See, which would deal with ecumenical subjects. And I think that had to do with the time that he spent in Romania, Bulgaria, and Turkey. He had contact with the Orthodox Church and with the Muslim world. And I think that had a lot to do with his formation and with his view of ecumenism and relations with the Orthodox and relations with the Muslims and the non-Christian religions.
But John the 23rd wasn't the only Roman pontiff of the 20th century. Pope Benedict the 16th mentioned on his first day in Turkey's capital, Ankara. During his speech to diplomats, in fact, he also mentioned Benedict the 15th, whom he described on this occasion as an untiring promoter of peace during World War I. A pope who was much misunderstood during his pontificate, but who, as his biographer John Pollard writes, the Turkish people remember in a special way. Quote, he got very little in the way of reward during the course of the conflict. On the contrary, he was attacked from all sides. However, ironically, the lasting monument to his humanitarian efforts came at the time not in any European state, but in Turkey of all places. In Istanbul, a statue was erected in his honour even before the war. Unquote. No surprise, then, that Pope Benedict XVI mentioned his predecessor during a gathering with roughly 90 ambassadors in Ankara, also in light of that first general audience of his pontificate back on the 27th of April 2005.
I wanted to be called Benedict XVI in order to create a spiritual bond with Benedict XV.
Al venerato pontefice Benedetto XV,
who steered the Church through the period of turmoil caused by the First World War. He was a courageous and authentic prophet of peace and strove with brave courage, first of all, to avert the tragedy of the war, then to limit its harmful consequences. Treading in his footsteps, I would like to place my ministry at the service of reconciliation and harmony between persons and peoples, since I am profoundly convinced that the great good of peace is first and foremost a gift of God, a precious but unfortunately fragile gift to pray for, safeguard, and build up day by day with the help of all.
Words these that came to my mind as Pope Benedict XVI then addressed diplomats on his first day in Turkey during a gathering with roughly 90 ambassadors. Respectful dialogue, he said on this occasion, must be the basis for ending terrorism, wars and religious differences in the world. Religions, he added, have a key role in this dialogue, but on the condition that they utterly refuse to sanction recourse to violence as a legitimate expression of religion. Perhaps one can safely say once again that Pope Benedict is doing his best, as promised at the beginning of his pontificate, to tread in the footsteps of that last pope to bear the name Benedict. Now, while my thanks go both to Sean Patrick Lovett, whose voice you've just heard, and to our sound engineers here at Vatican Radio for making this programme possible, I'd just like to add that Pope Benedict naturally was inspired to take the name Benedict also because of Benedict of Norcia, and that in another programme I'll soon be touching on the figures of the late popes Paul VI and John Paul II. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scarsbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org.
Laudator Jesus Christus.